better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,529 of the Survival Podcast. This episode begins at least a three-part series, because that's how many people I have respond to my request to talk about rabbits, to talk about rabbits. I personally think that rabbits are one of the most sustainable and best meat animals for home production that there is. I'm not saying not to feed them with pellets or anything, but, you know, if you had to, if you have grass and clover and fodder trees, you can feed rabbits for no money out of pocket. That makes them incredibly sustainable. They produce a wonderful manure that is a excellent fertilizer, composted or straight out of the bunny. And there's just a lot of support, a lot of options, a lot of the work's been done. There's different ways to raise them, hutches, colony, all kinds of things. And it just basically will fit anybody's needs. And I often get people asking me, well, Jack, if all that's true, why don't you raise rabbits? Well, I don't need one more thing to do. Number two, my wife won't eat them. And if I'm going to be the only one eating them, I'll do other things. But I really think this is a fantastic subject. And since I don't really know what I'm doing, because I've never actually raised rabbits, just eaten them, and most of the rabbits I've eaten, you know, involved a shotgun and a dog to acquire the rabbit, I thought I'd bring some people on that could talk about that. So I have Amy Lambrick on, and she'll be with us in just a moment. Hopefully I said her last name right. She can correct me if I did not. And before we do that, Lou, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today, is JM Bullion. Yesterday I talked about preserving wealth, among other things, in this tumultuous time that we're in, and I mentioned precious metals as one of seven primary strategies for that. Silver and gold have been money for as long as people have actually had what I guess you would consider money in our trade and our commerce, thousands of years, never been worth zero, and they never will be either. If you're going to stack silver and gold, though, here's some rules. One, if you can support something that you love, do that. If you love the show, use our sponsor. Two, don't spend any more money than you have to, because the whole point is it's all the same. Three, get free shipping if you can. And four, if you can get a discount, even better. Well, if you're an MSB member, you can get a discount on JM Bullion purchases. It's where I go when I want to stack silver and gold. It's where you should too. And they've been with us for a freaking decade, guys. A freaking decade of sponsorship in the world of podcasting. That's kind of unheard of. Next up today, you know, most of our audience, I would say, probably have animals in their life. And the animal that is undoubtedly kind of the most popular companion animal on the planet is the dog. And dogs can be a great blessing in a home, or they can be a problem. And it all has to do with their training. But you know what you have to do if you want to be able to train a dog? You have to first learn how to train the dog. If you go to Canine Academy, my good friend Joel Riles over there has courses that will help you become a great dog trainer, because dogs are never the problem. Dogs follow rules. They do what they're taught. It's really not that hard. But it's people who are like, well, I want to let the dog be a dog. And then the dog eats half your house or eats your chickens or runs away and gets hit by a car. Who knows what? So what we need to do is teach the dog to be a good citizen in the home and on the homestead, and then the dog can be a dog, and it'll be a very happy dog. And dogs actually crave having someone in control, having someone in command, and learning the difference between a request and a command is part of the training. Joel has a variety of courses available, again, at canineacademy.us. I helped him formulate these courses as part of our barter agreement. I have one of his dogs named Belle right here in our home. She's an awesome dog, and he's an awesome trainer and an awesome dude. So check him out today at canineacademy.us. With that, let's go ahead and bring our special guest on. Amy, welcome to the Survival Podcast. And did I butcher your last name there? Or did I get it right?
No, it's close.
Close enough?
Yeah. They say it different ways. Even in the family, they pronounce it differently. So
trust me, that's how I feel about Spirico. Spitu, yeah. Spurto, Sparco. I mean, there's letters that get put in a sixth additional name that I don't really understand, but I've been there myself. I do try to get names right when I introduce guests, though.
Yeah.
I usually ask that question, but like I said in our preamble as we were getting ready to do this and sorting out a technical issue, I'm out of sorts today. What I do want to start out with you, though, Amy, is how you got into, like, not just raising rabbits, but homesteading as well. Kind of like before you did any of this, what were you doing and what brought you here?
Yeah. So even from when I was a child, I was really interested in nature and things. Actually, I grew up in New York City, so it was kind of, you know, tough to pursue that when I was in the concrete jungle, so to speak. But my dad, he really enjoyed gardening, and we had a little postage stamp backyard, and he would tend it. And I think I kind of picked up that love of nature from him. And so eventually I made it out of the city and married my husband, and we live in North Alabama now, which is a beautiful green, lush mountains, trees location, and started our family. And one of the activities I was really into is running, and dabbled in triathlon, and I'm kind of competitive that way. And so part of my geeking out on that, I would listen to different podcasts about fitness and nutrition. And that just led me down to the fact that our food system was just so corrupt. So many things wrong with it. And, you know, with a growing family, I wanted to be able to provide good nutrition for them, and also for myself. And we were stuck in the suburbs. We didn't have a lot of land. And so I started looking around and found a patch of land, just not very large, but in the county. So that gives me freedom to, you know, raise animals without, you know, what getting in the way. So we have 1.7 acres.
Cool.
And it's about what I can handle. You know, at some point I was thinking, oh, I would really like to have more land and have some larger animals. But as it turns out, I'm the one who's really managing the property. And so for one middle-aged woman, it's really enough. And so wanting to develop the property well, and of course, down those rabbit holes, so to speak, that I went down, I found your podcast way back when, and heard about Jeff Lawton's PDC that he was doing online. So I enrolled in that and completed it back in 2013. And so that helped me really lay out my property, and then incorporate my livestock, of course, which in the beginning, I just started out with the gateway animal, which is the chicken, you know. So we got, and it's funny because we live on Buckeye Lane. And so I got Buckeye chickens.
Okay.
First. And, started out with them, but I wanted more meat sources. So with my research, I found, like a lot of people, that rabbits really fit the bill in many, many ways. That you have the meat source, you have the manure, the fertilizer, you have the fur potential, and then they're quiet. They don't take up a lot of space. Of course, the tough part comes in whether, you know, you can do the deed. And I kind of just jumped in. I figured I was going to have to deal with it when it came. And so when the moment came, I enlisted a good friend of mine who's a critical care nurse. And so she's used to, you know, blood and gore and all that. And so she said, I'll hold your hand, Amy. So she stood by me when I you know, butchered my first animal. And it was interesting. She, you know, being a critical care nurse, sees a lot of sick people. And the thing that came out of her mouth when I was cleaning the animal out was like, oh, look at those beautiful organs. So she had a young friar and just, you know, healthy organs. And really that just tells you a lot of, that's what you're getting. You're getting fresh, healthy meat that, you know, what went into that animal. And so,
that's a good point. Like, I would challenge anybody, like, don't eat them because they're junk, but go to the grocery store, use them for like fishing bait for catfish or something. Get a tub of chicken livers
mm-hmm.
from the grocery store, like from Tyson or Purdue or whatever, and look at the liver from a chicken from your backyard flock.
Oh, yeah.
That right there should be enough to end the discussion about this, because, like, the liver is what tells you more than any other organ, the health of the animal is by looking at the liver. And the livers of factory animals do not look good, and they don't taste good.
And, you know, just on that topic, too, you know, I've done meat chickens as well. And I have noticed sometimes I'll have a butcher day and we have other people coming in on that and bringing their chickens to butcher. And I have noticed the difference between the livers from the chickens that were raised on commercial feed only. And yep. my birds that free range and I give them fermented feed and whatnot. And the livers are so different. You know, the commercial feed chickens, they're like the color of mustard and they disintegrate in your hand.
Yep.
In your
yep. home.
And mine are nice and firm and red, you know. So really that what you're feeding your animals, it makes such a difference.
Did you ever notice how they are very proud of the fact that they sell chicken that's on a 100% vegetarian diet? But the first thing your chicken does when you open the door in the morning is run out and murder and eat something.
Yeah.
Like if there's a grasshopper, a fly, anything, it must die. Like same with ducks and other things. But I brought you on for rabbits, so let's kind of move into that. You kind of mentioned like they were like the way to more meat. Is that the primary thing that drove you toward rabbits is the meat yield that you can get from you know, breeding like several does in a buck can produce, I mean, like a half a ton of meat a year, which
yeah.
is crazy when you think about it. But, you know, and I don't think you should kind of push them that hard, but you can produce. I think I read one time something along the lines of two or three does in one buck produce without pushing the breeding too heavily, equivalent meat of like one full grown boar goat a year. And that's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I can't actually keep up with as the amount of meat that I raise.
Really?
I do have two livestock guardian dogs, so they kind of get the extras. Of course, you know, I started out with a trio, which is the two does and a buck.
Okay.
And now I've grown. I have quite a large rabbitry right now. I never know how many I have really because
okay.
it's. I think I have about between 60 and 80 right now.
Okay.
But a lot of them are grow outs. You know.
I'd say a lot of those are bunnies that have a pending graduation.
Yes. Right.
Yes. So do you have any idea what your breeder stock is right now?
Oh, the number of breeder stock?
Yeah, yeah.
Probably, I have about probably 20 or so. I do raise three different breeds at the time. Currently, I raise the American breed, which was my first rabbit. And I picked them because they were a heritage breed. Just lovely rabbit. And actually, I have... show and tell. I don't know. I have some rabbits next to
okay.
me. I didn't know if you
could yeah,
see.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Like? Okay, let me just reach down here.
This is where she grabs out the jerk stew.
Okay.
No, that's a nice rabbit.
So this is an American blue, and you can see they're very sweet. I don't handle them regularly, so
okay.
this is just a very sweet rabbit. This is the size of a fryer, so she's probably about between 4 and 5 pounds. So
okay.
this is a 10-week-old rabbit.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a fryer.
And
I have this breed is the darkest blue.
They're beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
They're beautiful in color.
Yeah, and they come in white as well, but
okay.
This is the American blue. And then I also raise Tamooks, which come in a lot of different colors. And
okay.
you want to see some babies?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever you got, you want to show?
Okay. So this is a little baby. So this one is a Tamook, and it's maybe about 3 weeks old.
Okay.
A little less than that. Eyes open for about a week.
Okay.
And that's a Harlequin color. And we have, they come in all.
If you're on the audio, folks, and you want to see this and you just want to jump to it in the video, jump to about 13 minutes. And remember, there's always audio embedded in the audio notes for those folks. Anyway, go ahead.
So this is an agouti colored rabbit. It's also a Tamook composite. And then one more variety I thought was really sweet. This is a magpie color. Again, another Tamook.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just say, though, with the type of rabbits, if you get rabbits that all look the same, it's easier to bring them to the freezer. But when you have like the composites, which... you think, oh, well, it's going to be more fun to see what's in the nest box and they might. But then, you know, you end up having a favorite or your kid you know, really gets attached to one, and they can tell them apart. So that could make things a little bit more complicated. So, but the American breed is very good for meat production. They were really the meat breed back in like the 1920s, but fell out of favor because other breeds like the New Zealand and the Californian came into play. They were like white pelted rabbits that could be dyed, and so they were used more, and the Americans fell off. And that's part of the reason I decided to raise them, because they needed some help. You know, I think back in like 2005 or so, they were so rare that at the ARBA convention, I think that I heard that someone said there were only like 5 showing, in which case, if you have less than 25 showing for a number of years, they just drop the breed from the American Rabbit Breeders Association. So, you know, they've come a long way from there, but they're still on the endangered list. So we're still giving them a hand by breeding them. So some people want to know, you know, what rabbits taste like. They're like, okay, I want to raise them for meat, but I don't know if we're going to really be able to incorporate them into our family. And, you know, the meat might look like chicken, but it is different. I would say that the meat is a little bit more firm. By protein, it has, I think, the highest protein level per weight. And then it has the least fat and least moisture. So that does make the meat a firmer meat. So a lot of times you wanna harvest them when they're younger, when they're like fryers, that age that I just showed you. Their meat's going to be a lot more tender, and it'll be good for like if you want to fry it, or if you want to saute it for like a stir fry. I prefer having rabbit when they're more in the roaster size. So we're talking maybe 3 to 4 months of age, live weight, I would say 5 to 7 pounds. And when you cook that rabbit, you get more meat, obviously. I think it could translate to about 3 to 4 cups of meat per rabbit. So I'd rather have more leftovers and cook it fewer times. So that's my target size for when I harvest them. But even if they get older, and you know, sometimes you have to retire a rabbit, which is really hard to do. But I really believe in, you know, utilizing the rabbit is respectful to the animal. And so when we have an older rabbit, a larger one, I guess they would call them a stewer, technically. I will use it for sausage. So I grind it up and make, you know, a lot of different kind of sausages. Like, you can do anything, really. I do breakfast sausages, chorizo, Italian sausage. And my latest experiment has been, I found a recipe for Spam. And I love Spam.
Rabbit Spam?
Rabbit Spam. Yeah.
I'm down with trying some rabbit Spam. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, yeah. If you go to my Facebook page for my rabbitry, Buckeye Rabbits, I have a picture of it produced. And I wanted to show you. So this is my new gadget. A deli meat
people
maker.
People use those for making like cold cuts and stuff. Like they chop up chicken. Yeah. For those on the audio, it's a stainless steel cylinder. It's got a spring and a compressing top. And basically you put meat in it, compress it, and then you set it in simmering water. If I know what that is, and I think I do.
Yeah, it has a little thermometer, so you can put that right down the middle and check the temperature. And I'm telling you, it came out just like Spam. I did add pork back fat with it, you know. So
I was going to ask, like, what do you do for the fat? Because the rabbit does not have span level
fat. It's just like with venison, you would have to add in some, you know, beef fat or some or pork fat to it. But it was so simple. It was like salt. It was like, what is it, that curing salt, the rabbit meat, the pork fat, and salt. And that was it. That maybe a little moisture, you know. But it was delicious. So
that's cool. That's really cool. And I want to compliment you right now. Something happened and my internet connection went to shit. I was able to tether my iPhone and jump back on, and the internet came back up, and I don't trust it now. We're sticking with the iPhone since it's working.
Okay.
Clearly I missed some stuff, but you just freaking rolled through that, and you're welcome. Just on that alone, you're welcome back to the show anytime, because things happen, and when it's the guest it happens to, that's one thing. But when it happens to a host, it can be hard. So kudos for that. So if I missed anything and you already covered it, I apologize. But how do meat rabbits complement other livestock? And I'm looking here, and you have on your list things like Muscovy's breast chickens. I'm wondering if you're part of our breast chicken group, guineas, pigs, et cetera. How do they kind of interplay with all that?
Yeah, so I like to have a lot of different varieties of meat, you know, options and things. So so I love my Muscovies because they have that red meat, you know, and I use them in a lot of different ways too. I've made duck pastrami with it. I make corned duck with it. What else? You know, a lot of different things that you can do with duck sausage. But that's my red meat. Oh yeah, and of course you can fry it or skillet like a sirloin steak, you know, so it's basically makes great bulgogi. And then I've got, of course, my layer chickens. I started raising some breasts a couple years ago. I liked the concept of being able to have your meat, you know, you raise out the roosters for meat and then keep your layers. And so been playing around with that. I've got my guinea hens. That's just part of my security on the farm. I get an occasional egg if I find a nest, but really I look for them to be my security. And then when they start, you know, making all that noise, my dogs will immediately run to that section of the yard, and then they'll be the muscle. So I like that. I also have a pig. I did try to raise some smaller pigs a number of years, but, you know, I only have 1.7 acres, and they say that, oh yeah, the coonies, they don't root, but they would root mine and just leave an incredible mess. So I'm down to one pig who got named. So she, you know, Harriet is still around, but she keeps the back part of the pasture, you know, mowed, so to speak, and got her insurance on the hoof back there. So, but the rabbits, I like them because they're so controllable. You know, all my other livestock, they're just kind of a little bit wild. They can do a lot of damage if they're on their own, but the rabbits, they're in cages. You control the breeding, you control when you're going to butcher. So it's been a good fit for our family.
Yeah, I like the sausage idea and incorporating other meats in that. I was telling people in the chat while you were talking, they were saying, item of the day, Jack. I'm like, I got a sausage stuffer coming next week. But we also had some questions. Normally I hold them to the end, but they're asking about the gadget. And if you go to Amazon, go to T-Spaz first, but if you go to Amazon, if you just search for meat press, you can see there's some of them are going to be the more like cooking ones, but the stuff she's talking about, ham maker, ham press, meat press, all of those will find it. If you follow Meat Dad on TikTok, he's a pretty cool dude. He shows how to make all kinds of cold cuts and stuff using those. But I like the rabbit spam idea. That sounds pretty cool.
But they make cold cuts too. I will debone a whole rabbit and I'll roll it and tie it, you know, kind of like a sausage. And I'll smoke that in the cold smoke and then just cook it in the oven, you know, on low heat. And then you can have slicing like deli meat with that. And it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to get me to not eat something that had a face at some point.
Honestly. Yeah.
I have a pretty big carnivore. But, you know, there's going to be people that say, well, what does rabbit meat taste like? So how would you answer that question to someone who's never tried rabbit before?
Yeah, so it's a little bit firmer. I would say that it has a slightly earthy flavor to it, but it's not strong. Like if you were to just cook rabbit by itself with no seasonings, you'll be like, this is not really chicken. But I've heard of rabbit referred to as like the tofu of meat, because if you use any kind of seasonings like Mexican, Greek, you know, teriyaki, whatever you put on it, it's going to just absorb that flavor and just meld into whatever recipe that you want to use. So so that's why it's so versatile. I think, yeah,
I would agree with that. I would say, like, if I took rabbit and chicken, especially thigh meat, side by side and grilled it with salt and pepper, nothing else, you'd probably be able to tell the difference. If I made something like a casserole or like a fajita or something like that, where it was seasoned and incorporated with other things, I don't know that the average person would be able to know. Like, I could feed it to somebody, tell them it's chicken, and they might be, this one's really good chicken or a little bit different, but they would never know that it wasn't chicken prepared that way. They would take it as a kind of a neutral, light-colored meat that takes on other flavors.
So the one, another place that you couldn't really tell the difference is canned rabbit. So I also can rabbit, pressure can it, and the meat really is just like canned chicken. And you right out of the jar, you cannot tell. So again, that's another really good use of, I look at it as a good way to store meat that doesn't require refrigeration, that I can just grab off, you know, the shelf and use immediately. You know, stir fries, soups, salads. So that's another way that I like to use the rabbit.
Yeah. Did you have any concerns about whether you'd be able to do the deed when it came to graduation day and you know, terminate the life of this thing that you're going to eat? You know, I've never had an issue doing that with like chickens and quail, but they're not cuddly. Like I have one chicken. She's pretty cuddly, but overall chickens are not something you pick up and sit in your lap and pet. Rabbits are kind of cute when they're little. Like, was that a struggle at any point?
I have to say, I have pushed back butcher day many times.
Okay.
I never enjoy it. I mean, I do it regularly, but it's not a task that is easy to do. But sometimes when you're running out of cage space and, you know, that part kind of pushes you into having to do it. You know, this is one of those things that I would say that if someone's going to be starting to raise rabbits, that's one thing that you definitely want to get good at using is your calendar. Because if you write down when you need to butcher them for the purpose you're going to butcher them, you know, whether it be 8 weeks at fryer stage or at roaster or whatever, put it down on your calendar so you can get ready mentally and gather all your supplies and clear out your calendar that day. And also anticipate, you know, what it's going to take to process the meat afterwards, because it's not just butcher day. You're going to have to decide, am I going to freeze it? Am I going to can it? Am I going to, you know, make cold cuts? Am I going to use it as a crock pot? So all these things determine and can keep you from butcher day, because there's a lot to plan for, you know? A lot of times I'll thank the animal and I'll hold it and express my appreciation for it. And I think that's a good way to honor the life of the animal, you know.
I would agree with that. And I also would, you know, whenever I have this discussion with anybody, I always end up thinking about one of the videos I saw with Joel Salatin processing chickens, which to me is an easier thing to do than a fuzzy little thing, but it is still taking a life. And what he said is, if you are doing this like as a profession, like as a farmer, and you ever get to a point where you have a slaughter day and you feel nothing, stop for a while. Mm-hmm. Wait a few days before you do it again. Like, if you feel nothing, then that's a problem.
Right.
Right. We should feel something when we take another animal's life. I mean, I'm a hunter and I love to hunt, but every deer I've ever killed, there is a moment where you reflect on the action itself of taking a life of something. And, you know, I think when we take a life for a purpose, there's an honoring of that life there. I also think of Robert Rourke's book, Use Enough Gun, where he talks about Harry Selby, who's like one of the most famous guides of that kind of 1950s, 1960s Africa time, who said to kill anything with no purpose is murder and it's always wrong. But you will always remember the day of the buffalo or the day of the gazelle or the day of the rhino. And if you honor something's memory in some way, if it feeds you, if it feeds your family, then it is a good and honorable thing. And I think that part of the problem that we have is people have lost touch with that. Like, they have no connection to their food, because if you did, you wouldn't want to eat chicken that comes out of a Tyson chicken house, right? You wouldn't want to eat something that was treated that way and disrespected that way. And if we did that, then we probably wouldn't have the crazy people in PETA telling us a chicken is equal to a person, right? It's like right. The whole thing is a problem because we took ourselves out of this loop mm-hmm. and we made ourselves immune to the reality of it. So, you know, I don't mean this in a negative way, but I'm glad you feel something. I'm glad that sometimes you don't want to do it. I don't sometimes. Like, I've had mm-hmm. chickens, like, they're actually a problem. Like, they're becoming annoying. I've got roosters that are spurring you in the leg and shit in the morning, right. And you're like, bro, you're going to go. And I still don't really look forward to doing it, not just because I have to do the deed, because like you said, okay, take three coal roosters, hang them from the oak tree, bleed them out in a bucket, throw the mulch away. That's the easy part. Now you got to either pluck or skin and part out, and then like there's work involved too. So I think that it's good that we connect to the negative aspect of having to take a life, but it's also then we also do some level of the work in raising that animal, processing that animal, cooking that animal. Now we're reconnected to the cycle that we evolved with, because humans evolved in that cycle. Go into any indigenous culture that's still around. They're never vegans. I challenge people, especially the vegan crazies, like, show me an indigenous culture that's vegan. They do not exist, and they never did. This is a natural place for us as a species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, though, I would say that butchering rabbits is quite a bit easier than butchering chickens.
Okay.
All I need is a sink. I actually do it in my garage that has a utility sink in it. Just two little strings with a slip knot on the bottom, a little counter, a knife, and a couple of buckets. And really, I can take a rabbit from cage to crock pot in like, you know, 10-15 minutes.
Okay.
And the cleanup is negligible, you know. So in that way, it's a lot easier. But the face thing makes it harder, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I will give you like my hack for chickens that's made my life easier. I don't full process anymore, but mm-hmm. I like skin on the breast. So I mm-hmm. pluck the breasts. I don't scald them at all. I just pluck them, and then I de-breast. Right. I take the legs and the thighs, and the dogs get whatever they want out of the rest. And it, you know, I'll pull the heart and the liver from that as well. But the rest of that is like dog and compost fodder.
Yeah.
And because when you chicken, man, it's like all those feathers along the back. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, I don't eat this. Like, I might make soup out of it or something, but like, I don't really need to be doing all this work. And I do that with cold ducks too, man. And all you do is when you have those little bits of some pin feather and stuff that don't come
mm-hmm.
off.
Mm hmm.
Take a little butane torch, singe it, and you're done.
Yeah.
Like, that has made my life easier. But a rabbit, I've actually never processed a domestic rabbit. I've mm-hmm. only processed cottontails that I've shot. And I think domestics might be a little harder to skin, but like the cottontails we would shoot, we just take and cut a little hole in the, now we're not saving pelts, right?
Right.
But we cut a little hole in the back and just pull. And you could pretty much... Mm-hmm. I mean, a knife was nice, but you could do it with your bare hands. But I've seen people process domestic rabbits, and it seems like they're more akin to skinning a squirrel than a rabbit. They're a little harder to get the skin off than a wild rabbit.
You know, it depends on the age. So if you have a younger rabbit, like 8 weeks, 10 weeks old, the skin, the connective tissue is very, very loosey-goosey, and really it just doesn't take much of a pull to kind of like deglove, you know, the hide from the carcass. Okay. When you get a little bit older, when you get more close to the steward's age, there's a lot of connective tissue and you'll have to tug quite a bit harder or maybe even use a knife to kind of like separate the skin off of the meat. So it depends on, and also the breed. I've noticed that some breeds are like way easier to skin. And then, I helped a friend butcher some, you know, kind of pet type rabbits, the smaller lion heads or whatever. And man, that those skins like never came off. They was just tough. So yeah.
My friend David, who has a sick, twisted sense of humor, but he's right when he says it. He's like, everything tastes better as a baby, right? And, I think he really means younger, you know, like he just likes to say weird things to tweak people and what have you. But I've noticed that with everything, like even quail. Like I did quail for a while, and I could pick up a quail that's a 6 to 7 week old quail, pop the head off, clean it like a dove in the field, no tools whatsoever, two leg quarters, breast, 30 seconds. Yeah, go ahead and try to process an 18-month-old adult layer that's in the molt that way. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, this you got the shears. This sucks. So I think everything like that, as we get older, we get tougher, right? There's a reason people like veal, right? Like the origin of veal is not, hey, let's eat the little cow. It's like, hey, we need to make cheese. We need to rent it. And then when they ate the veal, they're like, you know what? That's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
there's a place for that, I guess, you know? Yeah, yeah. What do you look for when it comes to getting good stock in your breeding? I know you breed primarily like an American breed of rabbit, and you know, people talk about a bunch of different breeds I've seen going in the chat here. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when people are just starting out, I can see getting kind of like, meat mutts or just, you know, cheap rabbits in the way that you want to maybe learn how to take care of them. And also to see if that's something you want to get into before you start exploding your number of rabbits. So I would say, you know, if you're not really sure yet, get a rabbit or two, get, you know, raise it for a few months, get the routine, get the rhythm of it. And then if you suck at it, you didn't lose a $150 rabbit, you know. Mm-hmm. I would say if you're really serious about raising meat efficiently and making it a part of your homestead, it does make sense to research the type of breed you want. And then also look for a good breeder locally. You can, you know, now with Facebook, you can find rabbit groups that are local. You can just ask around on there, you know, who's a good breeder with good stock, this breed. You'll have people chiming in left and right. And then you can then call them. I would talk to them and say, you know, how long have you been raising them? What purpose do you raise them for? You know, if you're raising for meat, you want to make sure that they're really raising meat. And then you might ask them what their growth rate's like, for example, when they're 8 weeks old. What is their weight at 8 weeks? What is their weight at 12 weeks? Because you want to hit certain markers. You don't want to get stock that's consistently underweight or slow grower. Also, you know, and if you do get reputable meat breeds, they were bred to have good meat on the carcass. So they will have a good loin, they will have good hindquarters, and the show standard of perfection that the American Rabbit Breeders Association puts out, if it's a meat breed, it's obviously going to have standards that are going to uphold that. And I'll just show you, this is the standard of perfection book that ARBA puts out, and it has every breed listed in there. And so, you know, that's a good place to go look for a good breed to raise for meat. That way you're not consistently wasting your time for less yield, you know.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Now, one thing I've heard advice, I think Nick Ferguson was the one that I first heard suggest this, is if you think you want to get into doing this, find somebody local that does rabbits, not just for stock, but somebody that actually processes them too.
Yeah.
And offer them 4 or 5 times what they charge to sell you a rabbit to come to their place and process one with them. take it home, eat it, and see if your family will eat it before you make all of this investment. Then you'll know, one, you like rabbit. Two, you can handle the process of actually, you know, slaughtering it and butchering the rabbit, and that your family will too, because otherwise you end up with this significant initial investment of time and money. And now you're like, oh, I don't want to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And that's one of the things that I do here at my rabbitry is I offer demonstrations of butchering, of dispatching. So I'll demonstrate that. I also offer, you know, instruction for people who want hands-on. So I will walk each person through hands-on, how to do it. And I advise people to, and you know, and I figured a lot of people need to see if they can handle that before they actually, like you say, make that big investment of time and energy. And then, you know, what are you going to do when you have 30 rabbits that you can't dispatch yourself? It's really hard to get rid of that many rabbits, you know?
Yeah. I have noticed like a lot of people that are breeders, like they make way more money selling breeder pairs or breeder trios or, you know, four rabbits with $1 or something like that than they do selling the rabbits for meat. But there's still, that's a limited offload market. You're only going to sell so many of those. Right. So like if you have 30, that might be hard to find a place for them all to go unless you have somebody next door with big livestock guardian dogs that does what you do and what John Willis does.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who are cull buyers actually on the show circuit. And there's a lot of show breeding, you know, show breeders that will have a lot of rabbits because usually there's like maybe 1 in 10 that you're going to keep as a breeder or as a show rabbit. What are you going to do with the rest of them?
Okay.
Cull breeder will come and buy the rabbits, and then they have other markets that they, you know, funnel them into, which could be the pet food market or other things. So, yeah.
Awesome. What is your daily routine like? Like, you get up in the morning, you get your coffee, whatever, and eventually you got to go take care of the rabbits. So on a day that we're not processing just normal everyday, majority of the day's maintenance out of the month, what does that look like? So somebody knows what they're getting into.
Yeah. So morning chores, of course, I have to do all my animals. But, you know, going out the door, feed the cats, walk down to the run. So I have a combined huge chicken run and rabbitry. I keep them together. So feed the chickens on the way in, and then I get to my rabbits. On an easy day where it's not really complicated, I need to get in and out. It's just a matter of, you know, I use open crock waterers. So I'll fill all the waterers with, I'll fill a bucket with water, first of all, and then I use a pitcher, and I just go to every cage. I like to have eyes on every single rabbit every day. And you know, I'm not going to knock other people's systems of having like waterers set up. But I like to actually look at every animal because it's so easy to overlook a problem. You know, a few days without eyes on an animal, you might be able to, you know, rescue it or avert a big problem. So I like to water every rabbit cage, look at them. And also you can tell how much they're drinking that way. You know, you can really monitor their intake. So I check their water that way. And then I'll go and I'll feed pellets for the most part, which is normal in the mornings. Now, if I have more time, I like to pick up forage and then use that supplementally in each cage as well. And that all depends on what time of the year it is, what's in season, what needs to be hacked back, you know. So I would say every time I feed them, it's slightly different. And I like to feed them forage that has more than one type of plant in it, you know. So I give them a variety of foods to pick from so they can kind of self-regulate.
Are there some things they really like, you can tell, like when you bring that thing in, they get after it, that they really prefer?
You know, they really like, they really like pear branches. I know that for a fact. So that's one of the things that I feed them in the winter. You know, you have to do kind of a
like small twigs of pear?
Yeah, yeah, kind of like, you know, pencil, like your finger width, like those suckers that come out or that you're trying to chew back in the winter. So I kind of kill two birds with one stone. I get to prune my fruit trees, and then I bring a whole bunch of them to the rabbits, and they will literally, I mean, they'll be like little white skeleton pieces, white twigs left in there. There's no bark or anything. And
so they want the bark and the cambium. That's what they're really after.
Well, yeah, they love it. They love it. So that's consistently, they like that. That and like apple branches. I also feed them willow branches. They really like that as well. You know, flowers, they like mustards and plantain. Really, they go for a lot. The weird thing, though, is, you know, you keep hearing about, oh, you got to feed your rabbits comfrey. And I know comfrey is really great. And I do. I have a lot of comfrey. But it's not their favorite.
No.
I'm kind of like, please eat it. It has so much nutrition. You know, eat it. It's your vitamin. But sometimes I'll go back, you know, the next day and they'll be all wilted and dry on the bottom of the cage. They haven't touched it. So, yeah.
I think animals take what they need when they need it. They have an intrinsic intelligence. And that's why I like the free choice thing. Right. I don't, you know, like I said, I've never done domestic rabbits. I will tell you, like growing up in Pennsylvania and having a garden, everybody's like, the rabbits are going to get in the garden. The rabbits never really bothered our garden, but we had a huge lawn and it was a mix of different grasses. But like the main thing I always saw them in, the patches of white clover. We had like white, it was, I was a kid, so I don't know if it was New Zealand or Dutch, but it was white clover that grew everywhere up there. And those things, you could, you know, you look at a lawn, you can see like this darker green patch of clover. Every evening, all those cottontails would be eating the heck out of that clover. It was also like those dadgum things had a calendar. It was like 2 or 3 weeks before small game season, they all just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go? I was going to 22 you.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you think most people struggle or fail when it comes to taking care of rabbits?
Yeah, so kind of going back to the calendar, I think it's really important to keep track of, you know, when you breed them, when to put a nest box in, when to wean them, when to when are you going to butcher them? Those kind of things keep you on track. You know, when you're not paying attention, time can go by and all of a sudden you have a management problem. You know, there are too many in a small cage, you know, they need to be weaned or so that's one thing. I think a lack of planning sometimes gets people in trouble. You know, other things are kind of like management things, small things that will trip you up. For example, if you're going to be breeding rabbits, you want to make sure your brood cages have what you call baby saver wire at the bottom of the cage, which is a little bit more smaller. It's like 1/2 inch by 1 inch openings, like the bottom 2 or 3 inches of the cage, because inevitably you're going to have babies that get out of the nest box and they like to kind of scurry and crawl. They want to find something to get under and they'll get to the edge of that cage and they'll just fall out, you know? So if you don't have that baby saver, they're going to be on the ground. And if you have chickens, you know what's going to happen to them. They're going to become chicken food or they'll, you know, get cold and die that way. Another thing is with the nest box, a lot of the commercial designs don't have a lip at the front edge of the box. And you know, you learn these things the hard way. You'll be breeding your rabbits and you'll all of a sudden they're babies outside the nest box. And it's, you know, it's like March or February and they're going to die from exposure right away. And you're like, what is it? How are they getting out there? Well, what's happening is mama is going to be feeding them in the nest box and they're latched on. Good. And when she decides that the, you know, breakfast bar is over and she jumps out, they'll continue to be attached and they'll, you know, be drug out of the nest box with her. But if you have what you call, like if there's like a little guard, like a lip. So when the mama jumps out, they get scraped off. It's like a baby scraper ledge on the front edge of your nest box. That's useful. And let's see what other things that might be. Oh, yeah. Another thing that I see people do is they'll want to save money and, you know, build their own cages, which is fine. The problem is when they use hardware cloth on the bottom of the cages, it's very narrow. The wire is too narrow and the rabbits will end up with sore hocks. They'll get sores on the bottom of their feet that will be bleeding and open, and they're sitting in feces because it won't fall through the quarter inch hardware cloth, and it's kind of a miserable situation. So I would suggest that if they're going to build their own cages, to make sure that they have the proper flooring, which is usually a half inch by 1 inch, like 14 gauge, welded, galvanized after weld. Is a really good quality to keep on the bottom. And that way, also, the urine is very, very caustic. So it'll easily rust through after, you know, a few seasons. But if you get that good quality bottom, they should last for years that way. So those are some of the things that come to mind.
And if it's not big enough, not only do they have issues with their pads, correct me if I'm wrong, but you also want to make sure pellets can fall through. Otherwise, you're, like, building up.
Oh, yeah.
Bird in the cage, and a lot of hardware cloth is small enough that it wouldn't pass through.
Right. And that's one of the, you know, maintenance things that, especially if you're feeding forage and whatnot, you're going to have things get kicked off to the corner. And of course, the rabbits, you know, they like to pick one area for their bathroom, right? That's why they can be housebroken and, you know, use a litter box or whatnot. And if you have debris in that corner that they like to use, you can have like a nice mound starting there. And so it's good to have like a good scraper and just clean out those corners regularly. Yeah.
And rabbit turd is not bad, especially once it dries a little bit, but turd and urine matted together with debris, not fun. Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's still poo. What about, Do you do anything for a profit? Do you think people can make money doing this? I mean, I would say I think it can be an income. I don't necessarily think it's going to be somebody's full-time income unless they're not really needing a lot of money.
Right.
Or they're breeding like very high-end, very expensive bunnies or something like that.
I would say that unless you're really like up to that commercial level, but don't expect it to be like an income that you can live on. However, you can make some money with rabbits. It could cover your costs, and also, you know, cover your to feed your family and to feed your dogs or whatever. So the breeding stock, like you say, is really where the biggest money is. And of course, to be able to have quality breeding stock, you might have to move into like show rabbit level. So around here, if you were just going to do like a meat breed, no pedigree, you can get a breeding rabbit for about $50, you know, decent. And actually, I sell my Tumuk composites for that. They don't have a pedigree. They're not a show rabbit. They're a meat rabbit, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you get to the show rabbit level, you can probably get more like $100 per rabbit if you have a show winner that's a proven breeder with awards and, you know, all the accolades and everything. You know, $200-$250 a rabbit's not unreasonable. And I know, like, especially in the super competitive rabbits at the national convention, I think I've heard of some New Zealand selling for like thousands or so, like.
So, not to me, but good on you if you can get the money. I mean,
right. But you got to compete at that level, though. That means you have to go to shows and pay your dues, so to speak, to get that reputation and the quality that people are willing to pay for.
There's competition and high level stuff in everything. I've seen people pay $500 for a beta, a little fish. You know, I ain't doing it. And I look at it and go, yeah, is it pretty? Yeah, really. And I see that $25 one over there and it looks pretty good. And that $5 one from PetSmart, it's a fish. It lives in a puddle. It's a mudfish, you know. But yeah, I mean, if that's your niche, like I also know people that spend $20,000 to buy a ball python, that it's a certain pattern or mutation or whatever. But not me.
There's something for everybody, you know?
Yep. You kind of mentioned that you do feed rabbits to your livestock dogs. Do you have like a process for that? Do you, like, John just does a cervical dislocation, pitches the whole rabbit to them. Do you do anything? He said, I think he also said, like, if the dog doesn't do it on its own right away, that, you know, he opens up the paunch, and once they figure out what they're dealing with, he just throws them to him. Do you do anything at all, or just give them to him?
I feed them to them in lots of different ways. So sometimes it's whole prey. You know, I have to say, sometimes when you're growing out your rabbits, some will not make it, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll have problems weaning and they get bloat and they'll die kind of in that 6 to 12 week period. It's not uncommon that you're going to lose some of the rabbits to like a weaning enteritis type of thing. Those rabbits I'll just throw into the freezer. I'll freeze them for a few weeks. And then when the time comes in my feeding schedule, I'll just feed it to them whole.
Okay.
So that's like a rabbit that might be.
They're really kind of smaller bunnies.
Two to 5 pound rabbits, you know, okay. Whole. But a lot of times I'll get my cast offs for whenever I'm butchering. And so I'll end up with the head, the feet, the offal, the hide. I actually will save that in, you know, some discarded Ziploc bag, and then I'll keep those frozen. And you know, I have to be honest. I don't feed them exclusively rabbit. But I do raw feed them. So I do buy a lot of the bulk of their feed, just as like 10 pound bags of leg quarters.
Okay.
So that's, I would say, most of the time they'll get that. And then when I'm butchering, I would feed them like a bag of that offal, like maybe once a week, you know,
okay.
to supplement, because, the leg quarters don't have all the other nutrients you need, you know, it has the muscle and the bone, but it might not have like the liver and all the other nutrients that you can get. My dogs will get all the kind of the cast offs. And then also if I'm going to be using a whole rabbit, sometimes, you know, you take the leg quarters, you take the loin, you take the forelegs, and then you've got that rib cage and the spine left over, which you could use in stock, but, you know, it's easy to just give that to the dogs. And so that plus, you know, eggs that are kind of dirty, so to speak, that you don't want to deal with. So that'll kind of round out their meals.
And so they're 100% raw, but you are buying in some of their feed. I mean, I do for ours for chicken now. We go to Costco Business Center. I get a 40-pound case of leg quarters, and it's like less than $1 a pound.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's actually – we started doing it, and I'm like, this is actually less expensive than buying them good quality bag dog food.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're happy. You know, they're happy as all get out. What is your like process for processing? Like, are you using cervical dislocation? How are you dispatching and then processing?
So my preferred method is to use cervical dislocation, and I just use the broomstick, you know, or a stick. I don't have a hopper popper or those other gadgets and whatnot. I find that the broomstick method is, you know, quick, and it's not fussy. I do it right on the floor of the garage, you know, okay. Get to the sink. Now, if you're going to sell the meat, I would say that might not be the way you want to go, because it does cause a little bit of discoloration in the shoulder area. They get bruised a little bit there.
Okay.
So it might not be a good way to present your, you know, a product and stuff. But for me, it doesn't matter. Most of that goes to the dog. So that area. Yeah. So it doesn't bother me. I have used a bolt gun. I had a friend who had a bolt gun. It's not my preferred method. I've actually had my husband shoot it with a .22 in the event that, you know, occasionally you'll have a rabbit that will dislocate its back.
Okay.
And you have to put it down. And, well, since its back is already broken, cervical dislocation by, you know, tugging on its legs, not going to work. So, I have him, you know, dispatch it that way, which is fine. But, you know, I like to feed the heads to the dogs. So I don't want to have any kind of bullet residue in the head, in the brain, if I'm going to be feeding it to the dogs. So, but broomstick method, I'll have those two strings hanging over my sink with a bucket, 5-gallon bucket with a liner. And as soon as I do the cervical dislocation, I'll immediately hang it up by the two hawks above the bucket. And I'll just use like kitchen shears or Fiskars or, you know, some really sharp scissor. If you do it right, there won't be any bone. It'll only be connective tissue. So you can just cut through the head with the scissors, and it'll bleed out immediately. It doesn't take very long for it to bleed out. Maybe it'll be bleeding for less than 30 seconds. By then, you know, the death throes is going to be done. I like to take a sharp knife and cut around the back hawk around here.
Okay.
And then pull it down so that there's separated. And then I use a lot of scissors. It's really, you can use whatever you're comfortable with, but you know, sharp knives, you want to make sure you sharpen them before you start. I like to have a little bucket of soapy warm water next to me, so that way I can rinse my tools in between cutting, or just, you know, rinse the hair and blood off my hands so that I can continue to work. Just pretty much, I'll then, you know, cut a slice down the center and then, you know, eviscerate. And most of it I will actually put in that sack for the dogs, you know. Mm-hmm. I do leave the anus in the bucket and whatnot, but, depending on my supply of liver at the time, I do keep the livers for myself. And the heart and the kidneys, and those are awesome to, you can just grind it up for part of the sausage. I think
liver and sausage does something I cannot explain, because I don't hate liver, but I don't love it. And I would say of all livers, rabbit and quail liver are my two favorites if I'm just going to eat liver. I went to an event at Nick's house one time, and we had a guy that was a falconer, and he took the guys out falcon hunting, and he got a couple cottontails. And when we cleaned them, we took the liver and the heart, put it back in the chest cavity, and we wrapped them up. We fireside cooked them, and I changed my entire thought process about eating liver by itself when I had rabbit liver that way. And it was like, you get a little piece, because we're splitting it with like 10 people and cutting two rabbit livers into 5 pieces each. And it was like, oh my God, is that good? But even liver that I don't have a huge affinity for eating straight up, something happens in ground meat and sausage that I liken it to salt. I have never eaten anything that I didn't want to put salt on, even chocolate. Salt goes good on chocolate. But you don't want to sit down and eat like salt with a spoon, but combined, it's more than the sum of its parts, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, those rabbit livers, though, they're huge. You'd be surprised at how big their livers are compared to their whole, for the same size chicken, I would say the rabbit liver might be 3 or 4 times bigger than the chicken liver. And it's very mild. And like 4 rabbit livers will make a pound. It's a lot of liver. But if it makes the best, sauteed liver with onions and bacon bits. I mean, that's one of the favorite ways that I fix it. And so that's a good way to
just, and don't even break my boys the gallbladder. You know? Don't break the gallbladder. Do not.
Oh yeah. You gotta take that little gallbladder off for sure.
Nasty. We had another thing where we did a fireside cooking with rabbits, and I had a friend with me, and we were doing the whole thing, dice up the liver and pass it out. And I saw as he was going in a little bit of green on it. And I tried to stop him. No. And I'm like, wait, don't stop him. Let's see how this plays out. And because, gallbladder is like this bitter, horrible thing. And like, that's one of the negatives with quail liver that they're so small.
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to get that little tiny gallbladder off without popping it. And if you pop it, you just don't even feed it to the dog. Because the dog will then be like,
You can't rinse that stuff off.
Let's go ahead and take some questions here. We got quite a few of them. You've been a hell of a popular guest. Again, thank you for carrying through when the internet screwed up on me.
Sure.
Hoscus, I guess that's how I would say that. Do you grow supplemental feed for the rabbits, greens and stuff, or are you just grabbing what's ever available?
Well, I do plan on specifically planting certain things for the rabbits. So one of the things that I did plant is a bunch of hybrid willow. So I've done that. I actually got some strains back when there was a vineyard out in upstate New York that used to work with Cornell University developing different hybrid willows for forage purposes. And I got some back then. They had a lot of different strains. So I bought a bunch of different strains to see what would work down here in Alabama. You know, I figured they're trialing them up in New York, so I didn't know which ones would work best down here. But I believe that they don't carry them anymore, unfortunately. I would buy them, you know, as a one stick, 1 foot little stick that you would just drive into the ground in the spring, and then they'll, you know, they'll take. But I have a whole row of hybrid willow that I harvest from. I also specifically have grown mulberry, white mulberry, for forage. Let's see, what else do I have? They love sweet potato vines, you know, so that's another, yeah, really good supplemental, feed. I harvest a lot of, annual, well, now, I didn't plant it, but I do kind of leave a section of lamb's quarters. You know, there I have like a section for the pokeweed. I have a section that goes lamb's quarters. You know, you just kind of let it do what it wants to do and then go harvest when you want it, you know. So
I was going to ask you about lamb's quarters. I would have to imagine they really like that.
They do. And it's got really good protein. And, it, you know, you cut it back and it's going to grow back. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to cut the whole plant down. So.
Yep.
They will eat that. Now, I know it has a lot of oxalates in it, so maybe you don't want to make it the primary food source. I have occasionally opened up a rabbit and they'll have a little sediment in their bladder, and I'm thinking that might be like, you know, kidney stones kind of oxalates that are building up. So you kind of want to keep an eye on that. Again, you don't want to feed anything exclusively, you know. And another thing that might be a little questionable, but from my experience, when I first moved to my property, we had a lot of Chinese privet growing, you know, on the edges, and I didn't know any different. And, that's what was growing in the winter. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give some of these to the rabbits. Loved it. They loved it all winter long, and, never had a problem with the rabbits. And then later on I find out, oh no, you can't feed privet to rabbits because it's toxic. But you know, I didn't find it to be the case. Actually, with my observation, I'm thinking too that it might have been good in that when I first started breeding the rabbits, I rarely lost any of the weaning babies. And then later on, I started experiencing a little bit more of that weaning enteritis, and I think that the privet really helps keep that toxic load down in their gut.
Maybe it's one of those things, the poison is the dose.
How much
do they get? Because
privet,
if they have
and
other things to choose from, then they're not going to overeat the thing that they need to not overeat.
Yeah.
The one thing that made me think of, I've heard from several people that figured out they like Yaupon holly, and they'll eat the hell out of it apparently. And it's the only North American source of caffeine.
Yeah,
and they've literally given the rabbits heart attacks because they'll keep eating and it'll sink their heart up. And like, oh shit, don't do that. You know?
Yeah.
And the reason it made me think of it is privet is often confused with Yaupon holly, which rabbits may be able to tolerate it, but you need to know the difference because some people make tea from Yaupon because it's a native source of caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad for people. Rabbits may be able to handle it, but we do not. Stay away from eating privet. What is your rabbitry setup like, and are there any books you recommend to help newbies?
Yeah. I do. I have a couple of books. I have this book here, the one that I really recommend. This one, Raising Rabbit by The Raps. This has been a really good one for a lot of good information here, practical information. They raise the American breed. They're actually, I think they're called, the rabbitry is called Rare Hare Rabbitry. They specialize in raising heritage breeds that need some help, but they also have gotten to the point where they sell, I think, commercially to like restaurants and stuff like that. So they're kind of a large outfit. But there's a lot of good information in there. If you want to feed your rabbits off of your homestead, good resource that I have found back when, and I think, Jack, you interviewed Rick Royden, I think is his name, the Rise and Shine Rabbitry. I used them quite a bit. He doesn't write as much in his blog anymore, but there's still a lot of really good information on there about the plants that you can and cannot feed rabbits or shouldn't, you know, and also the herbs that you can feed them, really good lists there. Another one is, I think it's called Beyond the Pellet, which is another book that was published that give you a lot of good ideas of how to feed your rabbits, not just commercial feed. And don't get me wrong, I mean, there's a place for commercial feed. It's easy. It's you don't have to guess if they're getting what they need. It's quick. But you know, of course, we want to be resilient. And in the case that the feed store is not available, you want to have options. So, but they grow quickly on it. And if you want good feed to meat conversion, that's what you'll go with. If you feed off your property, they're going to grow out slower. They won't be as well. They don't have all that. That's the other thing. So.
Okay. I got a question from Rumble, so I can't put it on screen. But I actually forgot to ask about dealing with heat. So this person lives in Northern Australia. Temperatures reach 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Are there any health issues with heat? I've known people that have lost rabbits to heat. You're in, I think, Alabama, so it gets pretty daggone hot in Alabama. Yeah. How do you deal with heat, and is there maybe like the right breed selecting can help with that or what have you?
Yeah, those are good points that you have there. So first of all, locating your rabbitry is really important. I have my rabbitry under two huge pecan trees and then under also a carport. So they have kind of like double layer of shade. And when you position your rabbitry under large shade trees, the temperature is going to be so different. I think I read somewhere that like if your ambient temperature is like 97 degrees, let's say, if you're under shade trees on the grass, it feels like it's like 87 or 89. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're out in the sun, even on the grass, it feels like 107. So just that in itself is going to, breed that you pick is important too. So, for instance, the Tumuk composites were specifically developed at Texas A&M to handle the heat. So a lot of times rabbits will go sterile in the summer. The bucks just shooting blanks, you know. So, but the Tumuks, they will be viable all through the summer. And then also the does will be able to handle, you know, the strain of kindling, which is giving birth. The rabbit can easily, you know, overheat when they're doing something strenuous like that. But the does can handle it. So the breed's important. I just added a new breed to my rabbitry called the Czech Frosty. And you can tell that maybe they're not going to like the Alabama heat so much. I'm a little nervous. They're from Czechoslovakia, and you know they have denser fur, they have shorter ears, so they can't mitigate the heat as well. So we're going to see how they do. I try not to supplement ways, you know, like some people will set up misters and they'll have fans and they'll put out frozen water bottles and whatnot. I have decided myself not to supplement them that way because I want to breed rabbits that are hardy for my area. I feel like if I keep doing that, they're going to continue to be weak in you know, in terms of handling heat. So I'm trying to work my herd to where it can handle the area better. I do know that I have a local breeder friend that raises the same breed as I do, and he just notified me that he lost three of his good show stock this summer already, and it's, you know, I'm thinking the difference is I have my rabbitry under the trees and his is in a covered shed that is is directly on the roof. And, you know, just that, I think, makes a difference. I have never lost a rabbit to heat since I've been raising them here for like 12 years.
I like the two tiers of shade. Yeah. I really do. I think that works really, really well.
The open sides, you know, the ventilation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Closed in sucks. I mean, like, it's an oven. Mm-hmm. You made an oven. Exactly. When, like, you know, I think there might be a place for that in winter in some climates, but... rabbits are pretty durable critters. Like I was just down in Bastrop near Austin for an event, and Nicole was there with me and our friend David. And David has a service dog. He's a big Muppet-looking Labradoodle or something like that, and a Border Doodle. And all of a sudden, he goes tearing off, and he's a service dog, so he doesn't do that. But it's a rabbit, and David was like, "Oh crap, it's somebody's pet!" And like it was like a white and brown rabbit, and like who the hell lets their pet rabbit run around? But we get the dog and the rabbit doesn't get the chomp and whatever. And that evening I look out and there's like six of them.
Oh no.
And so I'm guessing somebody that raised rabbits let a few go. And apparently all these domestic rabbits do pretty well at wild adaptation. But the one thing they have in those environments that they don't tend to have in a hutch is the ability to go underground. And you want to talk about drop in temperature or warming temperature, depending on the season. A burrow, right? Like if you build a house underground, you don't have to heat and cool it. And so I think that might be a strategy. We have somebody coming on next month about colony rabbits. So we'll talk about with them. Do you do anything with the fur?
I would like to do something with the fur.
Okay. We have a bunch of questions and we need a lightning round it. So
yeah,
I've never had anybody on about this that does anything with the fur. Everybody said you can and everybody's like, but I don't.
Yeah, I have like about 30 hides in my freezer.
Okay.
For that time, I have enough time to do it. I did try to do it one time way back, and I had 10 young hides, which were too – you have to raise your rabbits to at least 6 months before their hide is really tough enough to for it to be durable. But what I learned is it takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of upper arm strength, you know, when you're stretching it, when you're fleshing it. And at the time, I was raising two boys that were, you know, and I was like, I don't have time for that. So
all right.
I wish I could find somebody who want to take my hides and do something with them.
That's what I tell everybody. If you can find, because everybody talks about it, like, okay, well, you come over here, process my rabbits, and you can have the hides.
Yeah, yeah.
I think anybody that does rabbits would make that deal. If you'll do my skinning, you can take the hides.
Mm-hmm.
Would using rabbit poo in a Johnson Sioux be any better? I'll take that one. Johnson Sioux is a form of composting. Would it be any better? Well, it depends. That's one of my favorite answers. Well, any better than what? I would say that it is a fantastic material to add to a Johnson Sioux compost system. It's fantastic for any, like, worms love rabbit poo. Like, I know people that literally... poo falls out of cage into worm bin, and worm processes poo, and they don't really do anything until it comes to removing. And so I would definitely do it. I wouldn't say it's going to be better, though, because that's relative. Any thoughts on compost and rabbit poo? I mean, the beauty of rabbit poo is it doesn't need to be composted. All right. Lovecraft says, how much money in equipment to start? And let's say, I know that could be anything because you could cobble something together from scrap. But let's say somebody wants a trio and you wanted to do it right. Kind of what are they looking at in cost roughly?
So if you have a trio, I'm going to say if you've got the wire cages that you can hang, you know, suspend.
Yeah.
you can probably get a decent size cage and price for about, I'm going to just spitball it because it's been a number of years since I bought new cages, you know, $50 per cage plus, you know, a feeder. And I'm thinking probably $75 a cage. But then you also have to have grow out cage space. So really, if you start with a trio, you need at least five cages to do the whole cycle.
Yeah, because you do need place for the babies to grow out, and each bunny in that kind of system, or each rabbit, breeder rabbit, needs its own cage, right?
Yeah.
And like I've always heard, like, bring the doe to the buck, not the buck to the doe, because if you put the buck in the doe's cage, she might castrate him, and that kind of ruins the whole idea of, like, making more rabbits.
It happens.
Okay. It's one of those things. Like, there's a Beavis and Butthead episode where Butthead hits Beavis in the eye with a pencil and it sticks in his eye. And he says, it really does happen. And so I guess we just got that for rabbits. What is the time frame from getting your rabbits breeding then to butcher size, and what's your system that you use?
Yeah. So, you'll breed your rabbits, and then it's 31 days till they'll kindle. And then from there, it's another 8 to 12 weeks to when you butcher. So depending on when you butcher, from the time you breed, 3 months to 4 months, we'll have rabbits to harvest. And, you know, the beauty of that, too, is that the mama raises the babies. You don't have to do anything. So that's the difference between raising meat chickens. You know, you would have to you know, hatch them and raise them as chicks. There's a lot of everyday brooder, and if you're going to track with them, you got to move them every day. So that's a lot of labor, even though they might be ready in 8 weeks. But then if you think about it, if you go from egg, you have to incubate it, you know, that's about the same time that you're waiting for it to appear too.
You have to keep an eye on the incubator where the rabbit is an incubator, and you don't have to do it unless you're a jerk like me. And if you want more chickens, the chickens breed or they don't. I don't really. Only time I brood is when I buy new stock. When it comes to self reproduction on the place, the chicken broods the eggs. She gets to raise them. She bails out. The dogs eat the half incubated eggs. That's
right.
I've gone to the easy button. Do you age rabbit before you cook it? Great question.
Yeah. Recently, I have found that air chilling the rabbit is really makes the meat a lot better. Normally, I would you know, butcher it. I would put it in an ice bath, and you would have to wait a few days anyway for it to come out of rigor, you know, before then I would, like, continue processing. But now what I've done is I'll actually just put it in a tray on a raised up and let them air chill for a number of days and then part them out. But it's so much easier to handle the meat that way. The knife goes through easily.
The meat is a little stiff because I do that with deer, and it gets a little stiff, and it's much easier to get nice cuts.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it flavors is better too. It's just something about it. I also brine it. So sometimes I'll take the fryers and I'll put it in a brine and do that for a couple of few days. And then that makes, like, fantastic, you know, fried rabbit, especially if you have some extra pickle juice, you know, you just throw that in to the brine and then it just makes it fantastic. So yeah.
For kind of a dry chilling, air chilling, however you want to call it. What I've always used is I use the half sheet pans like we bake with and a cooling rack. And then that way it gets airflow underneath, and it's really simple. And I really, as every place as they are, I probably need to put those things on item of the day because I use them for so many things. We don't bake, and that's what they're for, but I mean, like, cookies, you know, we use them for, it just steaks. Like, if I'm going to make a steak tonight, I'll dry brine it in the refrigerator all day long. Salt both sides, throw it on one of those in the refrigerator, and it just sears beautiful. Like, there's something about aging meat that way instead of in water. Aging it in a dry, cold environment. Like I said, like a deer, you hang a deer. We used to, you know, in PA, it's cold enough in the cellar. We'd hang a deer for 3 or 4 days before we would quarter it.
Yeah.
And the difference in the way that knife goes through that meat, like you're saying, is night and day.
Yeah.
Nicole Sauce, so you guys clearly know each other. Favorite way to cook rabbit? We did hit on a bunch of ways before Nicole got here, but do you have any additional, like?
Yeah, so I do like to cook rabbit. One of the ways that I got my kids to get on board with the rabbit was, you know, if you go to the mall or something and there's a Chinese restaurant, they'll have like bourbon chicken. They want to get you to come and buy. They'll have bourbon chicken. My variation was I call it drunken rabbit. And
okay.
I use like the same recipe. So it's kind of a marinated kind of teriyaki type flavored chicken that I would, or rabbit that I would fix. And so I got my voice to eat it then. But I also like to use, I'll do two rabbits in the crock pot, debone it, and then use that to make a huge mess of white rabbit chili. And then I'll can it. So then I'll have a lot of meals just in a can already, ready to go. So that's another way that I like to cook rabbit. And lately, my husband's favorite way was for me to use a fryer rabbit, brine it with some, you know, pickle juice, whatnot. And I'll use my sourdough discard as a batter. And so mix that in there and then flour it a little bit more with some cassava flour and then do fried rabbit with that. And it's fantastic.
So I'll say my favorite way to cook rabbit and squirrel, this is always obviously squirrels. No, I don't know anybody breeds squirrels, but wild animal. We will part it out like a rabbit will quarter, a squirrel just split it in half, and then use like a steak seasoning and like a little olive oil to get it to stick and like a steak seasoning. And we'll get the grill scorching hot where you're afraid it's going to burn the grill and sear both sides and then throw it in foil. And then like that wrap where you get no release, move it over to the side indirect, turn the heat down to like medium high and cook it for about 20 to 30 minutes, depending on how big it is, in the foil after searing it. Ah, amazing. And it's stupid simple, right? It's really stupid simple to do. Rachel says, when do you wean and maybe put on grass? I wean at 7 weeks since my grow outs are tractored.
So I have done tractored my rabbits in the past. It's been a little frustrating for me because my ground is not really level, and I never did put a bottom on my cages. And so, of course, you know, you do the loose rabbit situation. And so I bring so much forage to my rabbits now that they do get a lot of greens that way. So, I'll wean them between 5 on the early side, let's say if I have a show coming up and I want to show mama and I have to take her with me. Or if I can, I like to leave them with their mom till they're 8 to 10 weeks if possible, if there's enough room in the cage and I don't have another show coming up and another litter coming, whatnot. I feel like the longer they are with their mom, their immune systems are stronger because they're nursing, and it seems like they just have a better chance of making it.
We really pretty much answered this, I think, already, because basically processing and culling are the same. But Rachel says, what is your preferred method of culling? Do you have anything to add here at the end? That's kind of our last question.
Well, you know, culling actually means just taking out of your breeding program, technically.
Okay.
So, you know, butchering or dispatching, or we already talked about, you know, some people will find a home for their rabbit that they no longer want as part of their breeding program. So that takes a little bit more time and care to rehome, you know, a rabbit. But I usually just send them to freezer camp.
Okay. Is there anything specific that makes you say, like, your genetics are out, you're not sticking around? I mean, obviously, really sick, not thriving, but are there things that maybe over a few years you've learned, like, something that maybe a newbie wouldn't see that you would see and say, I don't want that rabbit around?
Yeah. So if it has to do with what their meat on the carcass, you know, perhaps they have a hollow loin, or they don't carry a lot of weight in their hindquarters. or maybe they consistently are raising, you know, small babies, you know, things like that. Or maybe they're just a rotten attitude or you know, or a bad mom. So they can get cold for that. In the show rabbit way, you know, they might have a disqualification, or maybe their daughter is now going to outdo them in terms of their form. And then, so, you know, we'll retire the old one and go with the daughter. So,
yeah, kind of like roosters. Like, if you spur me, you go to the tree.
Yeah.
And if you make a prettier baby than yourself, you go to the tree. That's kind of the same philosophy. And this is not a question, but I just want to always thank people who super chat me while we're going here. Bonnie Blue does that all the time and says, great guest and discussion. Thank you both for the learning opportunity. Thanks, Bonnie. I appreciate that as always. This has been fantastic. Again, thank you, Amy, for carrying through our technical difficulty.
Sure.
It's going on like I was still here, apparently. I'll see if there's any dead space in there where you go, what the hell's going on, when I do the editing for the audio side. But that was awesome. Like, I'm like, get back on. And then boom, you're just going. I'm like, this is excellent. Been a great discussion. Thank you for heeding the call and coming in and talk to us. Mm-hmm. And I'd say to other people out there, you know, if you have something to discuss, follow the example here. You know, let us know. Fill out a guest form. It's a pretty simple process. Amy can tell you that. And Dorothy will handle getting you on. I don't take every application and bring people on, but I do take a lot of them, because I think hearing from people in the community that interact with other people in the community that are really doing these things is really important, because that sends a message to people. Like, if this person can do this, so can I, because we get in this weird space where, like, they're like special people. Like, they grew up, like they were born and then they were raising rabbits when they were 3 years old or something. And we all start somewhere, and it's usually not at 3 years old. So, thanks for being here today. Really great discussion.
Glad to be here.
All right, folks, real quick before we wrap up, let me remind you, if you like the show and the work that we do and you want to support it, you can always come help us out by doing your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Item of the day is the same one as yesterday. It is the Vavor Compact Emergency Air Compressor. It fits in your hand. It's in a case about the size of a brick that you would build a wall with. And it can save your butt on the side of the road. I think we sold about two dozen of them yesterday. So obviously they've been popular with people. I really believe if you do not have a way to inflate tires in your vehicle, you are kind of pushing your luck with sooner or later you're going to need to, and you'll wish you did. These things are about $60. There's some smaller versions that cost less depending on the kind of vehicle you have. Check out the write-up. There is a link in the show notes down there right below if you're watching the video. If you're listening to the audio, just go by the site, pull up episode 3529. You can always use the search bar to do that if you're listening to this somewhere off in the future. Also, do consider becoming or taking one of our courses at homefoodsystems.com. We have the bioreactor compost course. Talked about that a little bit today. And we have the principle-based permaculture design course. It is 100% free to take that course. There's really no reason not to get free information and free education when you can. I put as much work into that course, almost as I did the bioreactor course. It took well over 2 months to produce that course, and it's free. And I did that so that you could decide if you really wanted to take more of our courses at Home Food Systems. Fits well in our discussion today. I believe we should be able to produce at least some of our food in our backyard, whether we're in the suburbs or out in the country or anywhere in between. So consider doing that to help support the show, and consider becoming a member. The Member Support Brigade is a super easy thing to sign up for. Fill out a form, make payment, you're in, you get a login to a private website. Use the discount codes, get your money back, and then some. I hear from people at least weekly, a couple, three, that say, last year I spent $50 to be a member and I saved $350 in discounts. That's the kind of program that I put together, and it is the way that we pay the bills around here. Without MSB and members like you out there, if you are a member, I could not do this show 5 days a week. There's just no way. We are at a Wednesday interview day, obviously. We just had a great one. Tomorrow will be an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I do have enough material, so there's no doubt that we'll have that. Amy also mentioned two books, and I will make sure those find their way into the audio notes as well, along with all her social media stuff, like her Facebook group and her profile on X and some other stuff like that. Anyway, with that, hope you guys had a great one. This was awesome as far as I'm concerned. I will catch you tomorrow with the Expert Counsel Show.
just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.